and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I'm joined in the Brussels studio today by our own Georg Zachmann and visiting from the EUI, the European University Institute, Jos Delbecque, who is also the former Director General of the Commission's DG Klima and one of the inventors of the European Union's emissions trading system. This is important because today we are talking about the global effort to reduce carbon emissions worldwide. We are recording this on the 13th of November as the UN COP30 gets underway and as the European Parliament here in Brussels is considering voting on ways for the EU to improve and strengthen its own climate targets. We're going to talk about all of those things, what it means, why it matters, and how we can do a better job. Just, can you help people understand COP30? Where are we today? Why is this one important?
Well, BLM COP30 is 10 years after the Paris Agreement. And in the Paris Agreement, lots of important things were decided, except clear decisions on carbon pricing. Now, the Brazilians have always attached a lot of importance on carbon pricing, as did the Europeans. The Europeans established their ETS, the emissions trading system, and it works fairly well. I think emissions are now halved compared to when we started in 2005 without a major loss in economic activity. And I think carbon pricing, therefore, the Europeans have something to bring to the table. Also, China is establishing actually a compliance market and is already enlarging it or talking to include sectors that are very important in the European CBAM, the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism. So, compliance markets, carbon pricing, the Europeans and the Chinese have something to say. Now, the Brazilians bring in an additional perspective, which is carbon credits. When you do something good, you have a project in a developing countries and it reduces emissions. You can calculate those emissions and you can sell those credits on a market. So these carbon credits are a thing that is left over from the Kyoto Protocol, where it was created under the Clean Development Mechanism. But it is fair to say that a number of things went wrong because the quality of the credits, quality in terms of the environmental integrity of the credits, was sometimes doubtful. And a lot of those carbon credits were created, but the United States left the Kyoto Protocol. Later, Canada left, Australia left, and all these credits went to Europe. So Europe was flooded with these carbon credits, and we had to decide to close the door for these carbon credits because there were concerns on the quality. Are they really reducing emissions? And there was also an issue with the quantity because so many credits came in, they were allowed straight into the emissions trading system. In fact, all in all, Europe accepted 1.6 billion of those carbon credits, which is more or less almost the average emissions covered by an EU ETS. So quantitatively, that was important, and it contributed to the very low prices that we had under the ETS until 2016-17, when this restriction was kicking in gradually. Now, the emissions trading system of Europe is closed for those carbon credits, and it helped to have decent prices. Prices today in the European system are around 80 euros per ton of CO2. So, to sum it all up, we were open for carbon credits. We were flooded by them. Some of them were having a doubtful environmental record. We closed the door for them, and now we decide to revisit that decision as part of our new target on which we are going to see, hopefully today, a vote in the European Parliament.
Excellent. And this is all happening as the world gets together in Brazil to decide how it's going to collectively move forward. Georg, your work on European energy capacity and grids and all things switch to renewables has been so important for certainly helping my personal understanding of this and lots of other people's. You now have this idea for how the EU can set an example for the world and put its own targets to better use. Walk us through how that works.
Yeah. Hi, Rebecca. I mean, as Jos said, carbon credits in the past have been a relatively doubtful proposition. And now with the new targets being set in the European Union, we will most likely get 5% flexibility in the new system, which means that we will have a 90% emission reduction target compared to 1990 for the year 2040, which is very ambitious. And that's what is currently put up for vote. 5% of these emission reductions might be procured by mitigation efforts happening outside of the European Union, if I might simplify it like that. And the potential risk of that is a bit the scenario that that Joss described from the past, when the ETS was almost killed by a flood of these carbon credits. But on the other hand, I argue in this piece that in principle, buying mitigation outside the European Union can be not only good economically for the EU and globally, but it could actually lead to increased credibility of the global climate architecture and reduce global carbon emissions compared to a baseline. And how would that work? So the idea would be that indeed a certain amount of mitigation or a certain part of the European target could be fulfilled by buying emission reduction elsewhere, but not just some dubious carbon credits, but essentially linked to other countries' climate pledges. So one would implicitly buy a certain amount of the carbon space that other countries have secured in their nationally determined contributions. And ideally, that would be somewhat leveraged, that if Europeans buy, are allowed to put into their accounts 1 ton of mitigation, then they might have to buy 5 or 10 tons of mitigation in other parts of the world. That could still make sense for individual actors to do that, because compliance outside of the European Union's systems is potentially significantly cheaper. And we would need a very, very robust architecture to assess the quality of what is being brought into the system. And that is extremely difficult to do ad hoc. So it's very hard, even if you have certifiers and then certifiers of certifiers and hundreds of lawyers and accountants to make sure that an individual project is really providing additionality. As an economist, you always feel that assessing individual projects for their additionality is almost impossible because of all the systemic effects. So if you close down one coal-fired power plant and another one opens next door and delivers the same service, then you might have just paid essentially for the capital cost of the new plant. So therefore, you really need an architecture that also is allowed to look a bit backward. And the idea that I try to test with this Stroman proposal is that maybe foreign units are put into a sort of a central bank that starts to develop a certain exchange rate for them, because they say at the end of the period, say in 2035, 2040, they will allow the physical exchange of a foreign unit into a certain fraction of domestic units in the European Union. And as all the market participants would try to guess what the value of a, say, Senegalese unit is, they would essentially, the market would play a significant role in determining the actual mitigation value, which might be much better than can be done kind of ex ante by complex taxonomy rules.
And who would run this central bank? Would it be the UN? Would it be a newly created international body?
My feeling is that we would have a certain group of countries that I would call the carbon buyers that would be interested in buying international mitigation to meet their domestic targets. Typically then OECD countries, maybe not the US, but other OECD countries that are rich enough and already partially do that, like Switzerland and Japan, that together would set up such an institution and would give themselves the commitment to only buy high quality stuff. And such a carbon buyers club could essentially complement the UN architecture and essentially support it by its very existence and prevent some race to the bottom between the different carbon buyers and thereby be a stabilizing instrument in the architecture.
So like a bank for international settlements, but for carbon instead of for gold.
Exactly.
Exactly. In the next part of our podcast, I want to dig more into ETS. Just gave us a great intro at the beginning about how it was created, and then it sort of became so overcrowded as to be almost unusable. And so it was scaled back in terms of its interaction with the rest of the world. And now we're looking at reinventing it again. Just, I have two questions for you on that, and I'm sure you're also going to want to comment on what Garrick said, but let me throw this out and let you figure out how to organize it for us. One of the questions is, how do we build on what you said, trying to make this into a real market with a market-driven price as opposed to a regulatory-driven price? And then the other question I will come back to after we've put this in context, because it's too many questions at once. But thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I think there is a very important point in what Georg is proposing, and that is a contrast to where we were in the world under the Kyoto. That is that we need a buffer between compliance markets or other regulatory instruments and the access to those credits. Because in the past, that access was automatic, and there was no further interference into that. Automatic, once approved by the UN, it went into the European emissions trading system. And that is where the trouble started, because there was no additional check on the quality and there was no management of the quantity. And it destabilized the system, almost torpedoed the system, because prices were tumbling below 10 euros. It was not the only source, but it was a major source of that happening. And so how to shape up that buffer is, of course, a major governance question. And I think what Georg is proposing, a kind of construction of a central bank, makes a lot of sense, but is going to be challenging to make it work because the United Nations is unfit to do that. On the other hand, the European Union on its own is also too small to do that. So how to construct a club of carbon buyers where you would need a lot of trust from those, you know, going into that construction. And there is also discipline that is necessary, and there is a compliance mechanism that needs to be operated. But what I find the most interesting concept in what Georg is proposing is this idea of an exchange rate, because the European carbon price is around 80 euros. We observe today that on the voluntary so-called carbon market, prices are hovering around 10 euros, sometimes below, sometimes above. But say, between 10 euros and 80 euros, there is a price gap that needs to be managed. And this idea of an exchange rate makes a lot of sense. So conceptually, I think this is very attractive. Let's not look only at the quantity of the allowances or the credits that we are talking about. Let's also zoom in on the quantity. And then you have a number of governance questions that this future central bank will have to look at. I would say in the European context, the Commission could temporarily take on already a few of those tasks. The quality check could be done. One or the other category of credits could be excluded or included. I would plead for a relatively small and contained list of categories of carbon credits that we would accept. In the past, it was so open that we had the worst and the best combined in one pool of carbon credits. So when we study today to one major example in this kind of carbon credit management, that is Singapore. Singapore wants to be the hub in Southeast Asia for carbon credits, and they limited themselves to some five key categories of credits, including transition credits, you know, which could also be interesting for the European context when we look at enlargement, how to bring the candidates for enlargement into line for the future ETS. So that transition process is absolutely intriguing, but it's a good example. But Singapore is exploring some interesting avenues, and we have Singapore looks at China, of course, as having a compliance market, but also other compliance markets are emerging in the regions. Credits, carbon credits are being generated in the region. So as we in Europe have been absent in this debate for almost a decade, it's high time to come back. And that is where I welcome the proposal that is currently on the table. It's time to re-engage with the international community when it comes to carbon crediting. And that is now in Belém what is happening, because the Brazilians have put it up front as a major issue for discussion. And perhaps the emergence of a kind of carbon club or a club of interested countries ready to engage into deepening the discussion after the COP in Belém. So that could be a very new starting point for the issues we are discussing here.
So we've got two proposals going. We've got the one in Belém on the Carbon Club, and we have the one in the EU on the way to use the flexibility. Is that right?
The second one is the most concrete. You know, there is a precise number, and now people are looking at how many tons we are talking about. That's a precise number in a precise context, which is the compliance market. What is being discussed in Belém, let's see what the outcome is going to be. Because the UN, being the UN, always very difficult to agree something. The principles that are going to be advanced, that may be one go, but we need more than principles. We need operational details in order to come closer to the governance system that we may require. So let's see what comes out of Belém as the starting point for a discussion. But this club of countries interested in carbon pricing may be a very new point of departure, in which the Europeans have already made very clear, as did the Chinese, as did the Brazilians, that as did the Canadians, as did Singapore. So it's a new club emerging. We miss, of course, the United States because they are absent in Belém and they tried on carbon pricing. They have good concept and good economists, but they never could operationalize it because of the governance question. And that indicates how challenging the issue of governance on carbon markets is.
Super. So here's my other question from before on the European situation before we branch back out, which is, how does the Commission take on all this stuff while it's also trying to move to ETS too? Because that's also a huge mission scope. And just how do you do all this at once?
Well, the ETS 2 was planned to start in 27. It's now up for a delay of 1 year as part of this compromise on the target for 2040, which is a bit unfortunate. But, you know, the political reality is what it is. And it comes close to the issues we are discussing here. Because what we did not yet raise is that a target of 90%, if it were to be delivered only domestically, would face up with high marginal costs of abatement, because it's a very tough target. So cost containment is an issue that we should clarify for Europe as well, where we want to have the cost containment playing out on. The anxiety about ETS2 was the potential price rise of energy products for consumers. The gilets jaunes kind of political anxiety was kicking in. So this carbon credits offers a possibility of containing the costs, you know, that are going to be implied in the ETS2. It has not yet been said that ETS2 would be open for this kind of carbon credits. Instead, it is in the document that is on the table of the lawmakers today that the ETS would be closed for those carbon credits. You see how tough the experience still wades into the debate, the past experience of the failed CDM adventure. But I'm confident that Europe is only at the beginning of this reopening debate, and that what is being decided today is going to be a first important step to see how quality credits can be brought in Europe potentially, what the potential price would be, and where Europe is prepared to use them. So while it is excluded that they would go straight into the EU ETS as of today, I really would see an avenue, say, in the midterm perspective, that the issue of cost containment is also going to become a very important issue all over again.
Can I jump?
I would like, Georg, you to jump in next, please. And what I would especially like to hear from you as you talk us through this is how to juxtapose Europe's own concerns with ETS and ETS2 and the internal things with its international role. Because on the one hand, the EU has been this big leader. On the other hand, there are some countries that resent the EU for its efforts to lead. So help us understand it.
Yeah, let me first, try to raise the point that you just mentioned on an even more abstract level, that there is a conflict between control, so trying to keep mitigation in Europe in very clearly defined silos, like the ETS1 with its sectoral coverage, ETS2, then the non-covered sectors, the international emissions, negative emissions, all in very clear silos, versus trying to use as much flexibility as possible possible between those sectors in order to lower the overall cost of mitigation. And politically, it's often very attractive to work in these silos because one can politically control them better. One can also better control the distributional effects that might arise between different consumer groups. If one would to put together, for example, the emissions for households and transport with those for industry, the worry is that essentially households will have to shoulder a larger burden than today, while industry might feel a bit relieved. But from an economic efficiency perspective, of course, having it all under a joint system eventually would make a lot of sense. And we will probably have to navigate this tension, not only in Europe, but also with international credits for quite a while. And we should think about how we do that properly. On your question, Rebecca, on the international implications, we hear more and more statements, and we of course know that this is true, that European emissions, even if you include the UK, are significantly below 10% of global emissions at that stage. And we can, of course, try to be the front runner in getting to zero by 2050 or even earlier, and that will help us to develop technologies that will show others that we can do that. So it has a lot of benefits that we should not neglect, but we also need to make sure that the others kind of follow our lead, because without that, our efforts would have been somewhat futile. So we need to find instruments that really encourage to spread decarbonization efforts from the developed world also to the emerging world and those countries that are currently not putting up the efforts that are needed to contain temperature rise below 2 degrees. And this idea of using some of the targets in Europe that will then potentially be paid by emitters in Europe that like to get a bit more time and to use that to buy mitigation in other parts of the world that is very robust and that is linked to these countries' Paris commitments, in my view, would be a much more targeted step than many of the climate finance initiatives that are currently around, because one would really pay here for the effective mitigation, and everybody would understand why this Paris architecture makes sense again if within this framework these monetary transfers are happening to pay for mitigation.
Well, academic economists would say we need one carbon price for the entire world and a lot of flexibility. That would reduce the emissions in the most efficient manner. Of course, the world is very different. And that is where we are trying to find a proxy here. That is that some countries, like the EU, is highly industrialized, post-industrialized. Some others are industrializing. Some others have no industry whatsoever. So this idea of one single carbon price for the world is far away. Let's put it that way. So we have to find a proxy to that. And this exchange rate element is one thing, but flexibility between different sectors of society, also inside Europe and beyond, I think is an absolutely important element we have to revisit. It comes down to the efficiency with which and the cost with which we reduced carbon emissions. And the more we progress in towards a net zero world, the more costs are going to increase. And the more the efficiency consideration is going to pop up. Now, in Europe, the debate is, in my view, going to develop a lot on whether you can describe all these flexibilities and these governance arrangements into a set of rules, into a regulation. And I think that is what the paper of Georg is indicating, elements that could be taken up, like an exchange rate, where everybody knows in advance what the rules of the game are going to be. What is more controversial is a degree of discretion that may be necessary, and that is the carbon bank or the carbon central bank idea. Some discretion may be necessary in terms of crisis. We had one crisis where the carbon market was flooded with those credits and we had to change the regulation. It took us a hell of a lot of time, too much time, typically European, you know, where it took us, I think, 5 years to address the problem. But we got there. Now, there may be And the problem was the flooding of the market. We may face a future where the market becomes very illiquid because we are reducing our carbon emissions so much that liquidity issues are going to be present. And my impression is that one of the core elements of the ETS is the market stability reserve. And the market stability reserve was the reserve that was created to cater for the flooded carbon credits that came in. Perhaps we have to rethink the market stability reserve to consider the opposite, where liquidity may be so scarce that we may face price spikes. And if they would occur, the affordability of the system may be under pressure. The political acceptability of the system may be under pressure. So we have to give some thought to how to deal with possible price spikes that may happen as we move along to the world of net zero. That means the amount of carbon allowances is going to dry up and supply will be very scarce and demand may be very high. So this idea of a carbon bank, a carbon central bank, could in fact be found in its predecessor, which is the market stability reserve. And perhaps we can package a number of considerations that are emerging in this debate and that are very clearly described in Georg's paper in view of a future revision of the market stability reserve. And the heart is going to be what can be put in rules and what is left for discretion of an operator in times of crisis. Could be the Commission, it could be an independent agency, it could be a worldwide agency, you know, the jury is open for that.
I would like to briefly underline the point of liquidity that that Jos made. In my view, with the ETS1 and potentially also when we manage to get the ETS2 working, we have really great tools with very good European governance that is kind of the gold standard of global mitigation instruments that are highly efficient in themselves and that are very well governed. And it would be a shame if we essentially let them dry out over time without making use of this institutional core that we already established. So making the ETS system in Europe potentially the core for a more global effort could provide quite a lot of value because we would borrow the institutional history that Jos and his successors have built up with so much effort. We would make that available to other countries.
As we move into the last section of the podcast, I'd like to turn now to the private sector. One of the beauties of the UN system is that it brings all the stakeholders to the table, not just the countries and the international regional organizations. So where are the companies in all of this and what do we need from them?
In this proposal which really is a strawman proposal and probably requires a lot of discussion and further work on. The idea is indeed that the private sector in Europe can essentially buy a bit more carbon space for itself by paying for international mitigation. So here, the private sector is really directly the one that is putting the cash on the table and also then developing the projects and reducing emissions. But maybe one big note of caution, and that goes for the overall discussion that we are currently having on flexibilities. This is also Pandora's box, and I think everybody that deals with this topic of international flexibilities and carbon credits has not only seen the experience of the Kyoto credits, or CDM and JI credits, but has also seen all these voluntary offset market and other credits that have been created and that have come under increasing scrutiny. And the overall feeling is that their additionality is often extremely doubtful. And that my biggest worry at that stage, also with this discussion that we are having today, is we should really make sure that we do not misuse this opportunity to do something good for flexibilities, to just open the door to useless, valueless credits from reforestation projects of forests that are already there or whatever. I mean, there are so many bad examples out there. So that needs to be absolutely waterproof, that we do not let anything into our systems that is not not really up to the standards that we set ourselves.
And I would add that the private sector is very sensitive as well to the quality of the credits, because there is a reputational issue at stake. So if they make their net zero plans for 2050 or whatever date, and they are compensating, you know, the gap that they cannot reduce themselves through carbon credits, they don't want to get dragged into a debate that these were useless credits or that these were fake credits or credits that did not deserve the environmental label that they receive. So I see the private sector also being in demand for someone setting out a kind of stamp that is, this is quality, environmental quality, without any doubt. And that could also be one of the functions that a carbon central bank could do. One of the technical functions, you know, there are such a central bank concept, there are some technical issues and there are some policy-related issues. But on the technical issues, you know, checking on whether those credits coming on the market are worth the name they are claiming for is very important. Now, we see credit agencies coming up who are checking those quality. The market may establish some of those functions as well, but it's early days to set that out. In any case, the world of Kyoto under the Clean Development Mechanism is a world of the past. While I was there when that was negotiated, the concept was good, but the implementation was horribly bad. And that is where it went wrong. And the implementation is the governance question. And that is where it all ties up. Shall we be able to create a kind of governance vehicle to make sure that this market in which we should engage worldwide, because not all countries go for compliance markets, so we should engage in also from Europe, but make our voice heard when it comes to pertinent governance questions that need to be sorted out. And I already hear that some will say, ah, the European Union is there again with the little rules and the little checks and the bureaucracy that may be generated. You know, you cannot have your cake and eat it. If you want quality, someone has to define what quality is in order to reduce the reputational risks that companies will be shy of to take, because their shareholders may question, hang on, CEO, what did you do in buying fake or worthless credits that are putting us under pressure by NGO community and other private observers?
And what about the companies? Where do they fit in?
In the proposal that I brought forward, the idea is essentially that you have this type of central bank, and then you have companies like a steel producer in Belgium that wants to buy some carbon space. They buy some credits from, say, Senegal, but they cannot use directly those credits, so they put them into this central bank. In the central bank, based on the exchange rate of the day, they are allowed to borrow with the collateral of the Senegalese unit some domestic European units that these companies can use for compliance. And then private market participants will try to understand very well how good the Senegalese system is, how good our system is to identify what a good exchange rate is. So you essentially get an entire architecture around trying to predict the exchange rate between each country's credits and the European system. And ultimately, at a final set point, then this exchange happens based on how the central bank assesses the actual value, which happens then in hindsight, and therefore they can really be relatively sure that what has been procured makes sense. So if we, for example, assume that private companies could spend tens of millions of euros per year on buying such foreign credits, that could buy a lot of mitigation outside of the European Union. Whether then a country like Senegal says, okay, I'm only going to sell you credits based on some projects that you are doing here, or I'm selling you just a share in my NDC, is, from my perspective, less important. But if the Senegalese government, and I don't know even know whether that's a good example, is willing to get projects done there that help them to achieve their targets in order to really have a good exchange rate, because if they have a good exchange rate, they can sell their mitigation much more expensively, then that might be a win-win for both sides.
Okay. So we have governments that create the credits and sell them. They get bought by the people doing things that produce carbon, like your steel factory. And then that steel producer can deal directly with the central bank and or with private investors who can also deal with the central bank. The private investors or the carbon market people and the producers don't have to go back through a government agency once they've got the credit. Is that right?
So they can put in the foreign credits into the central bank and then borrow as using the foreign credit as a collateral domestic units. And therefore, you essentially have a firewall between what happens for a certain period of time to not kind of infect your domestic system in case something goes wrong in the foreign systems. You have the market establishing the exchange rate because they try to predict what the different relative values of the European and the foreign systems are. And at the end of the period, then the real exchange happens and the kind of compliance unit can be sure. But there's some form of buyer beware. So if you buy something and put it into the bank, then you are also somewhat responsible to check whether what you bought makes sense.
Super interesting. The role of the government once the system is set up is to create the credits and then to kind of keep an eye on things. But it sounds like it's the market participants who really do the work of making the system run.
That is in general the idea. I mean, as I said, it's a very early proposal and it's a very complex theme, as I think you got from this conversation. But in an ideal world, essentially the market established exchange rates will be good enough so that the central bank essentially in the end can rely on those to establish the final exchange values. If this is not the case, if the central bank itself will have to do the due diligence work, then so be it. That can also be the case. But the hope would be that the market really provides a lot of information over the course of time and is much better at assessing the relative value of the units than any bureaucrat could be.
So I would say we are entering a new world of carbon pricing, and we are at the beginning of that debate. And I think Georg's proposal is extremely rich to point at operational elements that will have to be sorted out. But I'm sure that many other ideas are going to land on the table. Hence, it's very useful to have a strawman proposal that is coherent in its proposal and see how others will have perhaps other, you know, variations on one or the other principle put forward. But I would strongly plead that the Europeans participate much more proactively in this debate. It has been a debate that was dominated by United States participants, was then followed by a lot of Asian participants, and Europe has stayed all too absent in this debate, and that is not good given the story we have to tell. Now, basic in the European position will be anything that needs to be done should not undermine the structure and the policy making that is delivering the climate targets that are there now. And I think that's a very honest point of departure. We should not undermine the efforts that were done in the past, but we have to build further on that. We have to complete them and through that re-engage with the world.
So as we head into the end of the podcast, I want to ask about some of the other things happening at COP. Laurence Tubiana, friend of Bruegel, who's been on the show before, wrote something recently, how this should be the people's COP. She and her co-authors wrote that this was a chance to really get much more democratic buy-in for the whole fight. And do you see the fight to restore the planet, of course. Do you see that as happening? And do you have any other broad thoughts about what we can expect from the next couple of weeks?
Well, what we can expect is a major emphasis on forests, the tropical forest issue, the Amazon, the place, Belém. You know, that's the point the Brazilians want to make, and they are followed by the Africans and the Asians. I think that's a very useful outcome. When it comes to the People's COP, I was asking myself as well, you know, we have been entrusting the states to come with NDCs, nationally determined contributions. Now it is up to the states to engage the people and to explain and to prepare and develop good policies. And they are different in Europe, and they will be different in Africa, and they will be very different in Asia because of the different cultures we are living in. And it is this cultural thing that makes to what extent we engage the citizen. What is useful in her proposal is that we should not relegate the task for emission reduction to someone else. We are all responsible. The citizen, the private citizen, can do a number of things. Private companies can do a number of things. Governments have to do a number of things. And all these elements have to fit well together. It's a jigsaw that needs to be made. And we need, you know, to engage the citizens, because after all, it is for them to approve the regulations that are being put forward by their authority. So I take it as a very important element, but perhaps not immediately relevant for many of the issues that will be decided at the COP. But delegates will take the messages with them for the further refinement of their NDCs, their national determined contributions.
Georg, what closing thoughts would you like people to take away from this? We've covered a lot of ground, a lot of really big ideas. Can you remind us of the key points you want folks to remember?
For me, the key is that we keep really the eye on the ball, as they say in jargon, that decarbonization is something we should strive for, that the 2 degrees target is something that we should really try to defend, even given the headwinds, that people are still looking into ways and finding new coalitions of how to ensure that this can be made happen, that we cannot wait for the US to come back before we engage into making progress here. So we need to lead more. So Europe needs to determine what is at stake for itself and puts up leadership. I believe that the climate topic is one topic that is not only kind of in good for fair weather situations, but is also a topic where Europe can show leadership on the things that it is good at: global governance, economic solutions, engaging with everybody. So I would argue that there's also some opportunity for European policymakers here to take what they always claim to want to take, some global leadership role in pushing this topic forward, but not as a kind of a post-colonial power, but in really cooperation with new partners to essentially push also back on the idea that fossil exporters are going to dominate the discussions over global economics in the future.
Thanks so much. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics, a podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. As you can hear, I'm recovering from strep throat, but I'm almost better. And by the time this podcast comes out, my voice should be back to normal. Been joined today by the amazing Georg Zachmann and our wonderful guest, Jostel Beka from the European University Institute. You can find Georg's paper and other related research on our website, Bruegel.org, where all of our research and all of our podcast archives are free to listen. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.